From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Today we are announcing a fifth COVID-19 case here in Illinois. Our investigations are ongoing, but here's what we know so far.
This morning, in isolation at Rush University Medical Center, a Cook County man in his 20s who was recently in Italy and returned to Chicago through O'Hare.
He was infected while in Italy, and all close contacts since his return to Illinois are being identified and being contacted.
The CDC has now confirmed our state test that the third individual tested positive for COVID-19. He was recently traveling, including a visit to a state with community transmission.
Because the third individual did not have international travel or close contact with someone known to have COVID-19, it is likely that they acquired the infection in the community, although it's not clear which community, whether in our state or another state to which he traveled. Because the virus has been spreading in some communities in the U.S., community spread here in Illinois is expected. However, at this time, we are not seeing widespread transmission of this virus in the general public, so we can still say that the risk to the general public in Illinois is low.
The risk to the general public might be low now, but Dr. Ngozi Ezike, Director of Public Health in Illinois, says community spread is likely here of the coronavirus, and we ought to start getting ready. This is State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Sean Crawford is away. With me from the studios of NPR Illinois on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. He's also a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. Joining me from the IPR Statehouse Bureau is Jamie Monks, who covers state government for the Chicago Tribune. Jamie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line from Chicago is Greg Hines of Crane's Chicago Business. Greg, welcome back to State Week.
Always a pleasure.
So, Jamie, I'm going to start with you. We were, I think, both in the news conference with Dr. Ezike and Governor Pritzker this week. Can you tell us what we know about the latest case of COVID-19 in Illinois?
Yeah, so it was announced yesterday that a fifth person has tested positive for the coronavirus here in Illinois. He is a man in his 20s who recently had traveled to Italy, and he's hospitalized in Chicago. He's in isolation. So he's by far the youngest case that we've seen in the state of somebody who's tested positive. I think all of the other four cases have been people who are 60 or older. In this case, state officials told us that his close contacts are being identified and contacted. I believe that they have also identified the flight that he was on. He flew back through O'Hare, and they've been in the process of notifying some of the people, I think, who were seated around him as well on that flight.
It was interesting. They said a few rows up, a few rows back, not necessarily the entire plane, I guess. And that's more than we know about the third and fourth case. So the first case was a woman who'd been to China, this fifth, and then it was her spouse who was infected. This fifth case was somebody from Italy. The third and fourth case, it was just a couple. They had traveled to California, but Dr. Ezike said not clear if they were infected there or here.
Right. So we were also talking yesterday a little bit about this idea of what's called community spread, where somebody hasn't traveled to another country and contracted it there or gotten it from a close contact, a spouse. And so there is the possibility that it was something that was contracted here in Illinois. It may have been while these people were traveling out of state. That's just not clear right now. There is some community spread elsewhere, and that is expected, I think, to happen here to some degree as well. But state officials are saying at this point in time, the risk of transmission to the general public remains low. And one of the things, or a couple of the things that they're telling people to do are sort of these common sense measures: wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, and social distancing. If you're sick, don't go to work, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and they just put out hand sanitizer dispensers on stands. They are all over the Capitol building now, outside the governor's office, by every elevator, anywhere where people are likely to touch door handles and things like that. Greg, Dr. Ezike was in Washington this week asking for more money, and I don't know if that was the thing that did the trick, but it seems like the spigots are going to start flowing from the federal capital to states and localities to try and fight this.
Yeah, if you're a member of Congress right now and you got scared constituents calling and demanding action, this is about as easy of a vote as you're ever going to get. President Trump, who signed the bill, noted when he signed it that he only asked for $2.5 billion. Congress ended up giving more than $8 billion. And my prediction is this is just a down payment. Epidemic appears to continue to spiral. There's going to be a lot more needed and a lot more coming. There's absolute need for it. The politics and public health are on the same page here, so it's coming.
Well, if you think about it, it's almost inevitable that there's going to be a wider spread of it. I was thinking, you mentioned about the airplane, only people a couple rows in front and in back. Supposing you're on the airplane, you're sitting near the back, and you need to use the restroom, and you have to walk up the aisle. Are the people that you pass by, are they potentially infected? If you cough, for example, or if you're driving somewhere, you get out and you go to a restaurant, you go sit in the restaurant, you sit at a booth, you use the restroom there, you go up to pay. You maybe hand your credit card to the person, or you put it in the little slot for the credit card. All those instances in which you touch something, if you were carrying the virus, there's a potential for you to leave traces of it for the next person to pick up.
Yeah, I think about this. They talk about don't touch your face. I must touch my face. I was touching my face right now as you were talking about touching the door handle in the bathroom in the restaurant and everything, Charlie. So,
we're in scary, scary, scary territory here. Nobody knows how bad this is going to be. Everybody needs to take a deep breath, but everybody also needs to be cautious. And the political class and our government absolutely needs to be at the front of dealing with all this.
Yeah. And there's these competing impulses where on the one hand, you don't want to panic people. And the public health officials say, it's important to get the word out. We want stories. We want people to be prepared and be thinking about this and think about what it would mean if you had to stay home for 14 days, if your kids had to stay home for 14 days. And again, we're not at that point now, but it is a possibility. And they just want people to start thinking about it. And so as we think about some of these consequences, Greg, I know you've been reporting there have been real-world mass gatherings that have been canceled, particularly a housewares show in Chicago was a big one that was announced this week. There was another smaller convention that's been canceled. And, Greg, I know you've also been looking at the effect this could have on the economy and particularly state and city budgets.
Yeah, this is really bad news. As we all know, the state of Illinois now has problems paying its bills after a big economic boom. The last thing it needs is a big economic downturn, but that now increasingly seems in the cards. The stock market was down again on Friday, which is going to hurt our underfunded pension funds, which are the root of most of the problems. Key sectors of the economy, at least in this part of the state, the aviation business, the tourism business, the hotel business are now in free fall. It's starting to affect logistics. If it reaches the point where people get scared, they quit going shopping, quit going out to eat dinner, they quit going to the theater, it'll spread even wider. None of this is good news for a state government that, here's the governor just a couple of weeks ago rolled out a budget that's got a $1.5 billion hole in it unless we raise taxes. I'm not sure that big epidemic that kicks off a recession is the environment for people to vote to raise taxes, which means we're even worse off. When I talk to government officials, they're all kind of wolfing by the graveyard and saying, well, it just started and let's see, and we don't know, it's early. But I think increasingly the government needs to be developing a plan B and taking a look at the alternatives and coming up with ways to deal with these problems.
All right. Well, this is certainly something I fear we will be talking more about in the weeks to come. So, Greg, you did happen to mention the graduated income tax vote. Of course, this is the constitutional amendment that's going to be on the ballot this fall. Voters are going to be asked, should Illinois end the flat tax requirement in the Constitution to allow for higher income tax rates? As currently scheduled, that would just be on the wealthiest people in our state. But Greg, there was a poll this week out of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. Can you remind us what did that say?
It said that this thing is in surprisingly good shape, that something like two-thirds of voters are for it. It's pretty consistent. It's a little lighter downstate than it is up in the Chicago area in the suburbs. But if I were J.B. Pritzker, I'd go have a drink after this one, because it shows that that it's the other side that's going to have to stop this thing at this point, unless something changes and the poll is right. And the Paul Simon people are pretty good. It's going to pass.
Yeah, and there has been some criticism of this particular poll. The universe of it was 44% women, compared to Illinois is actually 51% women. So definitely underrepresented women. But I went back, and because I've been following this issue for more than a decade now, and it's really been 65, 66, 70% in that range going back to 2008 in the Simon poll and in other polling. So there seems to be some consistency over time there. And Charlie, 65% would be enough to meet the constitutional threshold, right, for approval.
Yeah, the Constitution requires for approval of amendments either three-fifths support, 60% of the people who actually vote on the amendment, or a majority support among those people who vote for any of the positions on the ballot. One thing I wonder about, and I apologize because I did not delve into it deep enough to be able to answer my own question, the suggestion is that the poll undercounts women's response. Do the crosstabs show that women are significantly more in favor than men or less? Because if women are more in favor of the amendment, then the overall approval rate might even be greater than what the poll reported.
Yeah, my recollection, I have to go back and double-check, Charlie, my recollection is that indeed the situation is, as you described, that the women are slightly more in favor of it than men, which means there's even a bigger momentum behind this thing than you might think otherwise.
Yeah, and some of that criticism about the gender breakdown was pointed more at the presidential candidates, which obviously that field is shaken up. We'll come back to that. Just before we move off the graduated income tax, though, Jamie Fitch weighed in with its own vote, in a sense. They don't like to really take positions, but they did have a commentary, at least, on the graduated income tax vote coming up.
Right. So they said earlier this week that voter approval is critical to the state's outlook moving forward, and that if voters approve the constitutional amendment, it would appear to continue recent progress towards structural balance. That is also coupled with the caveat, though, that regardless, the state's pension situation will remain a serious point of weakness.
Well, that's a story we've been hearing a lot over the years, and I think we'll continue to hear more about that in the future as we get closer to that vote. Let's talk about, though, I mentioned a moment ago, the presidential campaign shakeup. I can't think of a more sort of interesting. I mean, I listen to a lot of political podcasts, and I'm about a week behind. So I'm hearing all these podcasts this week talking about, boy, it's really Bernie's to lose at this point, and whatever happened to Joe Biden, the moderates are so split. And lo and behold, South Carolina comes, Joe Biden cleans up. All the other sort of people occupying that moderate wing of the Democratic campaign throw their support to him. But Jamie, there's going to be a lot of names that Illinois voters will still see on the ballot. They may even be going to vote now as they're hearing this, because early voting is happening in most places in the state.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we've certainly seen a lot of changes in this campaign leading up to the Illinois primary. So, you know, hopefully people are paying attention to developments and know who's still in the race.
So, Greg, you had a piece this week headlined, What Illinois Can Learn from Super Tuesday. So I'm just going to start with that. What can Illinois learn from Super Tuesday?
Well, the two things at the top of the list are things I think that we know and most politicians know. Well, they tend to forget it. Number one is that in Democratic politics in particular, African Americans are absolutely central. If you go back and look at what happened in the last 10 days or so, this started in South Carolina, where blacks are heavily represented, unlike in New Hampshire or Iowa, and they turned out solidly for Mr. Biden. That provided an excuse for the moderate wing of the Democratic Party to do what the moderate wing of the Republican Party couldn't do 4 years ago, unite behind an alternative to the populist candidate, in this case Bernie Sanders. That's certainly one lesson here. Another lesson is that older people turn out to vote, unlike younger people, disproportionately. I mean, talking in grand generalities here, but in this race in particular, on this Super Tuesday, younger people were generally, which was the core of Sanders support, generally didn't turn out in the kind of numbers that their older peers did. That tends to be the case in a lot of elections, but people kind of forget it as you get caught lost in the moment. I think the third message here is that is to beware of what you ask for. The Sanders people pushed for more primaries. They said they didn't like caucuses, but in retrospect, caucuses are a better vehicle for Bernie Sanders because they tend to attract party activists and whatever, unlike primaries that attract a broader segment of a particular party's electorate. He kind of got hoisted on his own petard here, and that creates some problems for him, along with the two other factors I mentioned as we go into what's left of this nomination process, because if you look at the numbers pretty closely, they seem at this point, although I hesitate to make a final prediction, they seem to be much better for Mr. Biden than Mr. Sanders.
So, Greg, what about the remaining endorsements? So I saw Treasurer Mike Frerichs. He was an early backer of Elizabeth Warren. And like her, he says he's going to hold back before he announces. But I understand as we go to air on Friday, midday, that Mayor Lightfoot is planning to announce her support. Do we know where she's going to?
She has a 1:30 p.m. press conference scheduled along with Senator Durbin, who also has been uncommitted, which according to a press advisory, they're going to announce their endorsement for president. The advisory doesn't say who they're going to endorse, but it also says they'll be joined by a group of congressmen, including Mike Quigley and Robin Kelly and Bill Foster from up here, all of whom have previously endorsed Mr. Biden. So there's not really any doubt here what they're going to do.
Unless it's really surprising. But yeah, I mean, do you think that's going to matter? I've heard a lot of commentary that Representative Clyburn's endorsement in South Carolina was a big deal for Joe Biden coming at the end there. Do we think that Mayor Lightfoot and Senator Durbin will have significant influence on Illinois Democrats?
I think this is more of a case of getting on the train than leading it. If I had been advising the mayor and you really want to hit, in fact, I would have said do it Tuesday night or do it Wednesday morning. Now it looks a little late, but you never know. These are all popular officials. They all have a certain following, and I'm sure Mr. Biden is going to say thank you, not no.
Yeah, sure. So last thing before we move off of campaigns and elections, Charlie, there was a report this week that the Illinois Republican Party is going to spend money against a man who is running for a congressional Republican primary named Arthur Jones. He is a Nazi. At least he's affiliated with Nazis and Nazi ideas, Holocaust denial, that sort of thing in the past. Charlie, how unusual is it for the Republican statewide party organization to get involved trying to tamp down, somebody who's trying to run as a Republican in their own party?
Well, it strikes me that it was almost inevitable after the embarrassment that occurred a couple years ago when the same Arthur Jones wound up being the Republican candidate because the Republican Party in Cook County is what would be the charitable way to put it? Let's say they're not really a very potent force, and they didn't bother to put anybody up in the primary. Arthur Jones kind of snuck in, and then they were left with egg on their face when their candidate running against Congressman Lipinski was a Nazi. And there were some national Republicans who urged Republican voters in Cook County or in that congressional district to vote for all the Republicans on the ticket, but vote for Lipinski and not the Nazi. So after that, I would have bet money that the Republicans would do anything in their power to find somebody to run for that seat. It's going to be a losing battle. But to spare themselves the embarrassment, again, of having their standard bearer be a Holocaust denier, a neo-Nazi, it's just really a black eye for them.
You know, and I just thought of one other thing before we move off of elections entirely, and this is going away from the would-be Republican avowed Nazi candidate back to the Democratic primary. Jamie, there is one big voice in the Democratic Party that we haven't heard from in Illinois. What is Governor Pritzker going to be doing in this primary season?
We haven't heard from him, and from what he said earlier this week, we won't get an endorsement from him before Illinois' Democratic primary. He said, when asked about it earlier this week, that he doesn't plan to endorse.
So I guess, as Greg said, some of the other candidates are getting on the train. They don't want to get run over. He's just going to watch it leave the station and, I don't know, catch the next train.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like he's all in favor of the Democrat, whoever that may be.
Yeah, of course. He's definitely affiliates himself with the anyone who can defeat Trump camp, I think.
Indeed.
All right. So moving on from at least current or would-be elected office holders to former elected office holders. This week, former State Representative Aaron Schock had a message for his thousands and thousands of followers on Instagram. Jamie, can you tell us what did he have to say?
Yeah, so he came out in a lengthy Instagram post. He said that after a few years out of the spotlight, out of politics, he said, "I'm gay." He was talking a bit about his religious upbringing in the Peoria area and some negative reaction that he's received from his family. He was very critical of the media coverage, during the sort of end of his time in office, but also said that there was a lot of kind of speculation, and I think he even said dog whistling about his sexuality. He was in office for quite a long time. He was first on the school board and then in the legislature, and then he went to Washington in his 20s and got a lot of attention. But I think, that also came with a lot of speculation. So he addressed a lot of different things in that post yesterday.
He did, and I can remember. I mean, I can remember over the years the New York Times, in one point, 10 years ago, had a big style section piece about him, and it's a little unusual to profile a politician in the New York Times style section, and it had all this, detail about his workout routine and how he ate and what he didn't eat at the restaurant when he went out, with the reporter date for the story. And it was interesting to me. And Greg, I don't know if you have any view on the coverage of him over the years, but it seemed to me that I thought it was interesting that that story did not actually just come out and ask him about his sexuality, as it seemed to dance all around the subject.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Brian. I mean, having had a little experience with this coming out stuff, I can appreciate what Mr. Schock had to go through, particularly as a Republican in a party that has not been very friendly toward GLBTQ people. But the truth is that this was beyond an open secret in politics, and probably in most of his constituents too. I mean, the workout routine, the six pack abs. I remember just before we were on the conventions, I had breakfast with Mr. Schock, and he had the typical mid American breakfast of egg whites with spinach and blueberries. You know, but you deal with it in your own way. God bless. He's finally decided that it's easier to live as what you are rather than as something you're not. He has my sympathy. I'm not sure he's got a career left for other reasons, but now at least he can go on with the rest of his life.
Yeah, and everybody's Instagram feed, I guess, is a very selective, curated view into their lives, but it sure does look like he's having a pretty good time when you look at that. Pictures of him on various beaches, posing with Elton John, drink in his hand half the time, so he seems to be doing okay. Time now for our notes from the field. Jamie, I'll start with you.
Yes. So promising news this week for folks who like to enjoy the occasional adult beverage while traveling by train. The Illinois House passed a bill that would repeal the widely ignored Railroad Intoxicating Liquor Act of 1911, which prohibits consuming alcohol on trains and allows conductors to arrest riders for drinking alcohol and them to be charged with a misdemeanor. Anybody who frequents the Amtrak between Springfield and Chicago or rides Metra at certain times of day knows that this isn't enforced, but it's something that lawmakers in both chambers who are sponsoring the bill have called an archaic law that doesn't belong on the books anymore. And of course, this now moves over to the Senate.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, we're talking about former politicians, and I hope this is the last time that I have to discuss Rod Blagojevich, but I think an update is warranted. Last week, I mentioned as my note from the field that a panel of the board that oversees discipline of attorneys in Illinois, the Attorney Registration Disciplinary Committee, recommended to the full committee that Blagojevich's license be taken away, that he be disbarred. And in one of the news stories, the point was made, the panel is going to take anywhere from 1 to 6 months to make a recommendation, and then they send it to the Supreme Court, which ultimately decides his fate. Well, lo and behold, not in 1 month, 6 months, but in 1 week, the panel came back and said, yeah, he should be disbarred. And they sent that message to the Supreme Court. And maybe by next week we'll be able to say, yes, Blagojevich is disbarred.
Greg Hines.
Personal note from the field. I just got back Sunday last from Australia, and I can tell you one of the questions we had on the entire trip, we were out there for 3 weeks, Australia and New Zealand, was, you know, where were we going to make it back? Where was Trump going to seal the borders and whatever? Interestingly, while Fox News here in the States, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, continues to downplay the epidemic, Rupert Murdoch's paper in Sydney, The Australian, had big prominent headlines all week, the best of which was, we're all going to get the virus, quote unquote.
All right. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Greg Hines of Crane's Chicago Business, and Jamie Monks of the Chicago Tribune. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.